Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For the last week and a half or so, U.S. and Afghan troops have been fighting Taliban forces to secure the southern town of Marja in the Helmand province. The situation remains serious, but apparently it's no longer deteriorating, according to Defense Secretary Robert Gates. And my question was right off the bat, deteriorating as compared to what? To get a better understanding of what's going on over there, we've invited McClatchy Newspaper's senior national security and intelligence correspondent to the show. Jonathan Landay is going to be in town tomorrow to speak at an event sponsored by the Mershon Center for International Security Studies tomorrow. You can go to mershoncenter.osu.edu for more information on that. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
My pleasure to be here.
Okay, so you're going to talk, the title of your speech tomorrow is It's the Region Stupid, The Real Dangers of U.S. Failure in Afghanistan. What are those real dangers?
Well, what we're talking about is the threat of instability that can spread from Afghanistan to the rest of South Asia. Pakistan is already experiencing very serious internal instability that's related to Afghanistan. And beyond that, what's going on in Afghanistan is very much related to the 60-year-old rivalry between Pakistan and India. This rivalry, where Afghanistan is concerned, has to do with who will exercise the most influence in Afghanistan after a U.S. departure. And that role has been played for decades by Pakistan. India is not in a mood after what's happened in Mumbai and other attacks that have been perpetrated by extremists from Pakistan to allow Pakistan to re-exert its influence in Afghanistan for fear that those same elements that have been used against India will then find a new place to have a sanctuary from which to operate, not just against India, especially the disputed region of Kashmir. Beyond that, you also have a very tenuous situation in Central Asia, which borders the northern part of Afghanistan. The dictators of Central Asia have for the last two decades suppressed even moderate Islamic groups there. They have a huge youth bulge, massive unemployment, enormous amount of repression, and those are very toxic ingredients in terms of the susceptibility of Central Asia to Islamic fundamentalism coming out of Afghanistan. So there's a lot at stake, and the focus of the administration, the Obama administration and the Bush administration, when it comes to prioritizing why America is in Afghanistan, has been focused on the threat posed by al-Qaeda. And I believe that while al-Qaeda does pose a threat, that threat has been substantially exaggerated by American policymakers, and by doing so, and they do so because they need a way of justifying American policy to American voters. But I believe that an even greater danger is the threat of instability in that region, and it's a region, let's not forget, that has nuclear weapons.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Landay of McClatchy Newspapers. Give us a call if you'd like to talk with Jonathan, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, Jonathan, talks are going to resume, I guess, tomorrow between India and Pakistan. Good sign?
Well, we'll have to wait and see. Mm-hmm. You know, as I said, these two countries have had an ongoing rivalry, fought three wars, fight almost continuous small arms clashes along their borders for the last 60 years. These will be the first talks that would have been held since the 2008 terrorist attack in Mumbai. And it remains to be seen what will emerge. They haven't even been able to agree at this point on an agenda. Indians want to talk about terrorism, i.e., Pakistani patronage and sponsorship of extremist groups that have been used in India in sort of what is known professionally as asymmetric warfare. You know, you have a country, Pakistan, which is much smaller than India, has a much smaller army, much smaller, fewer resources, and for the last 60 years, ever since the beginning of independence for both countries, the Pakistanis have tried to make up for their inferior standing, strategic-wise, military-wise, mm-hmm. by sponsoring and patronizing guerrilla groups. They've done it in India. They've done it in Afghanistan. And so the Indians want to talk about that. The Pakistanis, on the other hand, they don't. They want to talk about Kashmir. They want to talk about this dispute that has existed mm-hmm. for the last 60 years or more over. The status of Kashmir, the region in the north of India and Pakistan that has been divided between the two of them since they went to war over it for the very first time back in 1947-48.
Now, the U.S. policymakers support the fact that they're resuming these talks. They say it's a good sign. Pakistan has said that stalemate with India is kind of the reason why they've been dedicating their resources to that eastern border. It's been an excuse they've given for being distracted from the terrorists in their borders. What about that? I mean, U.S. policymakers, is that a legitimate thing to support at this point?
Obviously, yes. The Americans definitely want to try and get some kind of dialogue restarted between India and Pakistan because Pakistan has India is the Pakistani military's major worrier, and they dedicate the vast bulk of their armed forces plus the heavy weaponry they have to their eastern border with India rather than taking care of their internal threat emanating from the federally administered tribal area, which is that region that borders Pakistan that has traditionally not been controlled by the government. But a lot of experts, and I count myself among them, believe that the Pakistani preoccupation with India is actually overblown and exaggerated, and there's a very good reason why. Pakistan is one of the world's few nuclear weapons powers, and the last thing India wants is to undermine and destabilize Pakistan the way Pakistani officials like to say, because they would end up having a failed state with nuclear awash in conventional weapons and with nuclear weapons in danger of falling into the hands of Islamic radicals on their western border. That's the last thing that India wants. From my perspective, the reason that the Pakistani military continues to make India its top priority and focus its resources there is as an excuse to legitimize the vast over amount of money they get out of their federal budget for military weaponry and for the army itself. If they didn't have an external enemy, if they didn't make mm-hmm. India, which is the regional superpower, their external enemy, they would not have the excuse they need to spend millions and millions of dollars, rupees, on things like F-16 fighter aircraft. And so I have a hard time accepting the Pakistani contention that they have this major threat from India, that India is intent on breaking up Pakistan.
As far as I can figure out, there's not a big consensus in India that this is going to do any good, but I can't seem to get a reading either way about what's going on in Pakistan, you know, what people there think about this resumption of talks.
It's hard to fathom that as well. Although I, having covered this area and lived there for the last 25 years, I think that there's been a substantial shift in popular Pakistani views of India. A lot of younger people are fully aware of how India has taken its place as a giant in the global economy, is moving ahead with political reform and economic reform, and they would like to be able to see Pakistan also follows a similar path in terms of economic reform, in terms of joining the world economy, in terms of improving educational opportunities and overhauling the government. So I think on a certain level, a lot of Pakistanis believe that Pakistan's problems really emanate from inside of Pakistan and not from India. But I think on the whole, I think there's still a lot of animosity between the two countries. There's a huge amount of distrust, especially in India after what happened with the attack mm-hmm. in Mumbai. And so it's very hard to predict what's going to happen with these talks.
Now, back to Afghanistan, particularly, they say that they've been making inroads since beginning that military operation 10 or 12 days ago. But it's unclear how much U.S. and Afghan forces actually control. Do you have a sense about that yet?
Well, I mean, it's clear that they control the internal part of the center of Marja, Marja Markaz, the district center, as it's called, where the sort of the main bazaar is located. But this is an area, and I've been there. I haven't obviously have not been there for this operation, but I've driven through that part of and spent time in that part of Helmand Province. It's very spread out. It's an area that's crisscrossed by irrigation ditches and canals and very heavily heavy agricultural area, and it's very, very spread out, as I said. And so getting complete control of that area is going to take a while, but that's not what really is going to determine what happens in Marja. There's two points I want to make here. The first is that what really will make the difference is whether or not the administration, the civilian administration, and the police that take over security in this area can, in fact, administer it properly, can, in fact, run it honestly. And that's going to be the problem, because there is an enormous amount of distrust, almost outright hatred, by people in that part of Afghanistan for the central government, and because legitimately there's a huge amount of corruption. Especially the police are extremely repressive when it comes to dealing with people on an everyday basis. And if they start, if the police that go in there and the new administration that is put in place by the American-led offensive goes and conducts itself the same way that most local administrations do in Afghanistan, then this operation will fail. That's my first point. The second point is that this is just a warm-up operation to what is going to be the real hard slog. And I don't even know when that's going to happen. This is an operation that's in preparation for a U.S.-led offensive to clear the Taliban out of their spiritual and cultural capital, Kandahar, which is the capital of the neighboring province of the same name, Kandahar. It is the, as I said, the spiritual and cultural capital of the Pashtun people. The Taliban have several years ago, infiltrated large areas of the city, which they basically control at night. They come out onto the streets with weapons. This is going to be an urban battle for Kandahar, and that's what the Marja operation is a warm-up for.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Landay. He is Senior National Security and Intelligence Correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, a veteran foreign affairs reporter. He's written on U.S. defense, intelligence, and foreign policies for nearly 25 years. He's going to be here tomorrow. He'll be speaking at Ohio State University and also Ohio Wesleyan University. If you want more information about that, go to owu.edu or and themershoncenter.osu.edu. And, of course, you can always go to wosu.org/allsides for those links. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'd gladly take your calls and emails at 614-292-8513 or at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Texas gubernatorial candidate Deborah Medina told Glenn Beck she's not a 9/11 truther, but
there's some very good arguments, and I think the American people have not seen all of the evidence.
The Texas Tea Party, the incumbent, and the senator all square off, and that's just the Republicans. I'm Neil Conan, a Lone Star edition of The Political Junkie. Ken Rudin joins us next. Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation begins this afternoon at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 31 degrees in downtown Columbus, scattered snow showers today, an accumulation of less than half an inch, and then a high later this afternoon of 35 degrees.
Support for WOSU comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television, and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover WOSU public media.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher and our conversation with Jonathan Lande of McClatchy Newspapers. Jonathan, I was reading an article, I think it was in the New York Times. It was about how the mayor of Marja had met with 50 elderly men kind of near the main bazaar in town to talk to them about the U.S. and Afghan military operation and explain to them that it would bring positive changes and that they're not here to occupy the country and so forth. And the elderly men were not very moved by this. And they make the point in the article that the Afghan government is almost universally loathed, illuminating the deep challenge facing Marines and civilian stabilization specialists. Is that the case, universally loathed?
Almost so. And that's what I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
That's going to be the major test. The gentleman that the Marines and the new mayor of Marja met with were the tribal elders from the tribes that dominate that area, and their support is absolutely critical to the success of this operation, in that they, for the last 8 years or more, have essentially been working with the Taliban, or at least coexisting mm-hmm. with the Taliban, also coexisting with drug and narcotics producers yeah. in that area. This is an area that is in the center of Helmand's poppy industry, poppy used mm-hmm. to produce opium, which is used to produce heroin. These are networks and relationships that have existed for a very long time. And again, as I said, what they are concerned about, obviously, are a number of things, the first being the honesty of the new administration that comes in, and especially the police. The police have got to be the most despised and hated institution in the entire country, simply because that paying bribes to a police officer is almost in a daily occurrence mm-hmm. for an ordinary Afghan, or a regular occurrence, to get anything, to avoid being arrested, to avoid being targeted by the police. You have to pay bribes, and so that there's going to be the success of this operation is going to depend on the honesty of the police and the honesty of the local administration. But then also, as I said, then there's also the question of, if you cooperate, you could very possibly end up with your throat slit mm-hmm. and the throats of your family slit as well. And so there's a great deal of fear everywhere in Afghanistan about cooperating with the Americans or the government, because it's been the experience, at least for much of the last 8 years, that because there was such a shortage of foreign troops and police, or at least honest police, mm-hmm. You would have the Afghan or American security forces come into one of the villages. Let's not forget, 70% of the 32 million Afghans live in the countryside. They would show up in a village, spend a day or two there, and then leave. And they'd expect. And I've been I've been embedded with troops when they've done this. They've gone into the village. They've brought doctors with them, and they've brought medical supplies and food supplies. And then they'll say to the elders, "Now, who are the Taliban? Tell us." And the elders will look at them and say, "Yeah, what are you talking about? You want us to tell you who the Taliban are, and then you're going to leave tomorrow." And this has been a very, very major problem in Afghanistan. The fact is that security has largely been a temporary thing. As I said, you have these American patrols coming in with Afghan security forces that spend a day, and then they won't show up in a village for another month or 3 weeks. And so that's a problem that obviously is greatly impacted on the attitudes of the elders in Marja as well.
It seems like that's been the sensibility about Afghanistan from the very beginning, when they liberated, in quotation marks, in the first place, raining their leaflets down on the folks who live there. But a few years later, we found that the Taliban was gaining strength again. Why is it so difficult to understand the dichotomy there?
I think there's a couple of things here. The first is that the United States military, when it intervened in Afghanistan in 2001. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was a historic occurrence in Afghanistan. It's the first time in centuries of Afghan history that an outside military power has been welcomed in Afghanistan. The United States, I got to Kabul about 4 or 5 days after the Taliban were expelled. And literally, as opposed to Iraq, people were dancing in the streets. People were absolutely tired of the repression that they experienced under the Taliban, and they were grateful for the fact that the Americans came in, and they were able to listen to music again.
Yeah.
I mean, music is a huge part of Afghan culture,
yeah,
and Afghan life, which was suppressed completely under the Taliban. But then the Bush administration squandered that opportunity by diverting American resources, troops, time, money to invading Iraq. And so over the preceding 4 or 5 years, the Taliban were able to regroup inside Pakistan. The Americans, because they decided they were diverting all of this, all of their military and security resources and monetary resources to invading Iraq, brought back and used, put in charge as their proxies, the very same abusive warlords whose abuses gave rise to the Taliban in 1992. And so with the Americans came back these very abusive warlords, and that began turning public opinion against the United States. The Afghans saw the world's strongest military power come into their country, get rid of this repressive regime, and then they saw a return of the deprivations that they had experienced earlier under the warlords that the Americans brought back and paid millions of dollars to. And then they saw the Taliban come back, and they started asking questions as to why is it that the strongest military power in the world can't get rid of this ragtag, very unpopular Islamic fundamentalist movement. And the longer that continued, the stronger the Taliban got, the more abuses that people experienced under the government, and who is still composed of many of these warlords, the support began ebbing for the United States and turned against it in many parts of Afghanistan, and especially against the government. And that's in a sort of a very quick nutshell, mm-hmm, how it was the United States lost the goodwill of the Afghan people. And let me bring it down to a micro level for you. Back in 2004, when this transition was taking place, when this change in Afghan attitude was taking place, I spent about half a day walking around the campus of Kabul University. This is the country's premier institution of higher education. It's where the next generation of Afghan political leadership was being schooled. And I spent time sitting and talking with many, many students. And these, as I said, this is the educated elite of, mm-hmm, Afghanistan. And they're telling me about, they're saying to me, well, the United States is here because it is waging a war against Islam. They can't get Osama bin Laden because they don't want to, because it gives them the justification of keeping their troops occupying our country as part of this war. And I was astounded to hear this from the educated elite of Afghanistan, and it began to occur to me that this was really one of the primary problems that the United States was facing at that time, and that in fact has grown, in fact helped fuel the deterioration in conditions in Afghanistan.
They weren't just losing the physical war, they were losing the mental war
and
as well.
They were winning the physical,
right,
war. I mean, you know.
But they abandoned that.
But it has to do with the fact that they lost the hearts and minds,
right,
because, as I said, you know, for many reasons, but primarily because they brought back the very warlords whose deprivations gave rise to the Taliban in the first place.
If you're just joining us, it's All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. And my guest is Jonathan Lande of the McClatchy Newspapers. And if you haven't figured it out, we're talking about Afghanistan and the whole region to boot. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And caller from Worthington, you're on the air with Jonathan Lande.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question. Even our military brass says that there has to be political solution to the Afghanistan war. Yet, at the same time, our action is emphasizing more military solution than political. It's about time we match our action to what we believe. And I think that it's time for us to de-emphasize military action and really get back to the basic of trusting Afghanistan people to solve their problems. They have done so in the past. They know the lay of land and the people, the culture, and they should be able to, we should not underestimate their abilities and trust them to come to terms with even militant Taliban. And I think it's about time we believe in our democratic principles and trust these people to solve their own problems. We should be readily available to help what they cannot do themselves. But I think still Obama administration expanding Afghanistan war by 30,000 more troops injected in it, it doesn't make sense to me.
Okay. Jonathan, what do you think?
Well, I think your caller raises some very good points that would have pertinence in a perfect world. But this isn't a perfect world, and Afghanistan has complications that have precluded any kind of political settlement and for years and continue to do so. One of the main problems is that the Taliban leadership, and we're not talking about a united leadership, we're talking about a number of separate groups. At the moment, the hardcore Taliban leadership doesn't want to talk. Mm-hmm. They feel that they have had the momentum with them. There's a saying, the Americans have the watches and we have the time. you know, and this is a feeling that has been strengthened, that was strengthened by President Obama's announcement in his strategy speech in December at West Point that the United States will begin pulling its troops out of Afghanistan in July of 2011. That sent signals to everyone in that region that the United States presence is temporary, and therefore people have no real incentive to engage at the moment in serious negotiations. Now, that doesn't mean to say that there haven't been talks going on secretly. There have been secret contacts, people feeling each other out, seeing where they stand. But at the moment, the main Taliban leadership, known as the Quetta Shura, led by Mullah Muhammad Omar, has made it very clear that they are not in the mood to talk with the Americans at the moment. They've said, at least publicly, that they aren't going to engage in political discussions until all foreign troops leave Afghanistan. Now, that may be something, that may be just a bargaining position. I think what we're going to see this year is both sides jockeying for a position that gives them negotiating leverage over the other in an effort to try and get talks going, which for me means that this year promises to be perhaps even bloodier than last year, which was the bloodiest year in the last since 2001 in Afghanistan. The other problem in all of this is that there's an ethnic component to this. The Taliban is almost exclusively comprised of the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan, the Pashtuns, but 60% of the population are non-Pashtuns. They control, they're part of the government, and they don't want the Taliban back. Neither do many Pashtuns. And so it's a very complicated situation. It's one, if the Afghans were capable of solving it themselves, mm-hmm. the United States wouldn't be there. No one would be there. But the fact is that one of the things that the Afghans cannot provide for themselves is security. And without security, you don't have conditions to hold negotiations.
You know, when you mentioned that saying Americans have the watches and we have the time, it reminded me of another element to that conversation they were having with those 50 elders. And that was that one State Department official was listening to the conversation and piped up that 2 years is about all the time we've got.
That's absolutely correct.
That's not
Obama.
A lot of time.
No,
I mean,
this is
not just time to win the war, but to win their hearts and minds,
right,
is what they're talking about.
Exactly. And this then opens the door for meddling by the regional powers.
Mm-hmm.
And Pakistan, which sees Afghanistan as being within its orbit of influence, it has been for decades, and they intend not to allow – the Pakistanis don't intend to allow their position there to be eroded. They're going to want to dictate terms. They're going to want to ensure that their interests are taken care of in any negotiations that take place. Meanwhile, the Karzai government has bolstered its ties to India. And so that throws another complication into any effort, any potential for any kind of meaningful talks to take place. And it actually throws potential fuel on a post-U.S. On the fire of what – and this is what I intend to speak about when I'm there – about what will happen if and when the United States pulls out of Afghanistan. My fear is that the country will revert to the civil war, which was largely fought along ethnic lines, that was interrupted when the United States invaded in 2001.
We're going to have to take another short break. My guest is Jonathan Landy of McClatchy Newspapers. We're talking about the war in Afghanistan and everything else around it. Give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org to talk to Jonathan. Jonathan is going to be in town tomorrow. He'll be speaking at OSU and also at Ohio Wesleyan University. You can go to our website at wosu.org/allsides and get the links to both of those organizations and find out more information. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Your business will also be associated with a trusted source for national and local news, arts, and culture. For more information, contact Christine Schottich at 247-4469. And thanks for supporting WOSU 820, NPR News.
And thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher this morning. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here. We'll hear about women reinventing retirement, transitioning from working full-time to living full-time, with the Transition Network Executive Director and two of its members. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 31 degrees in downtown Columbus, scattered snow showers today and cloudy skies, a total daytime snow accumulation of less than half an inch, and later this afternoon a high of 35 degrees. Snow showers tonight and a low of 22, we could see a new snow accumulation of a little less than an inch, and then a chance of snow on Thursday as well and a high of 32 degrees.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Jonathan Landy of McClatchy Newspapers. He is a senior national security and intelligence correspondent for the newspaper chain. He's a veteran foreign affairs reporter. He's written on U.S. defense, intelligence, and foreign policies for nearly 25 years. He's an expert on Afghanistan. If you'd like to speak with him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And, Bob, you're on the air. You want to talk about how do you keep the populace from turning to the Taliban? Robert,
yes.
I'm sorry, Robert.
Yes, I was a Marine officer, and I had the first anti-guerrilla warfare training back in 1961. And we learned mainly from Mao Zedong, and his guerrilla war basic principle is a guerrilla is a fish who swims in a friendly sea. And I think that applies also to insurgents, which means, okay, this is what it means to me right now. So we're successful in Marja and other cities and even the countryside in Afghanistan, and we bring in the government in a box, and we get better government in the short term, and then we have subsidies and things to help keep the populace in the short term with us. But in the long term, it just seems like the populace can be so ephemeral and go back to the Taliban. And I think that's a real, I don't know the answer to it, I'm not sure anyone does, but it's frustrating. But I don't think, well, I think the people now realize that a guerrilla war and anti-insurgent warfare doesn't have a front line. It's so much depends on the populace and who they will support. And then I have another observation. As a former Marine officer, I read a book by Donovan Campbell, and from March until October of 2004, he was in the company that was in Ramadi, and they suffered more casualties of any military unit since Vietnam. And a book I recommend to anyone who wants to know sort of what's going on.
What was the name of that again, Robert?
It's Joker One, A Marine Platoon Story of Courage, Leadership, and Brotherhood. And I wasn't in combat. I came very close. And it's the most graphic portrayal of what not only the Marines, but the NATO troops and Army troops that are in this urban warfare are going through now. I recommend it.
Thank you. Thanks for your call.
So I don't know if your guest wants to comment on any of that, but the long-term keeping the populace from being the friendly sea in which these guerrillas and insurgents work, I just don't know what the solution is. Maybe your guest knows in the past, who has ever won, what country, a guerrilla or insurgent type of war? I don't know how many countries have won those.
Oh, there is a history of that. The British in Malaya, it took 14 years, and it was treated as largely a police operation. It was run by a senior British policeman. And the Indians have successfully dealt with the Sikh insurrection in their state of Punjab. I covered that while I was in the region, and it was done through political means. And yes, absolutely, and that's what I was talking about when I was saying that the real test in Marja of what's going on is not the military campaign that's taking place right now, but whether or not this campaign is going to put in place an administration in that part of Afghanistan or any part of Afghanistan that can be trusted and work honestly with the people that they are in charge of administering, or the area that they're in charge of administering. And that's going to be the real challenge. As I said, the most hated institution in Afghanistan is the police. And if the police that are put in place in Marja during this operation just revert to the same conduct that police in most of Afghanistan, the same conduct that of the police in most of Afghanistan, then that area will almost certainly go back to the Taliban once the United States or other NATO troops leave.
Let's turn to the topic of Hamid Karzai. It's in the news now that he's made it so that he can handpick the members of an electoral monitoring commission,
yes,
which removes basically any outside oversight of future elections. And, of course, it was bad enough in the last election, the distrust that was going on. What does this mean?
It's going to be really hard to say, but I think the distrust of the government is already high enough.
Mm-hmm.
This is simply, icing on the cake. What has happened is that there is an institution called the Election Complaints Commission, and this was a commission that is the election watchdog, and its five commissioners had been divided between two Afghans and three foreigners, and it was this commission that essentially threw out 1 million votes that were cast for Hamid Karzai in the August 20th presidential election because it judged them fraudulent, and there were probably more than that.
Mm-hmm.
But by throwing out the 1 million votes, this commission forced Karzai into the runoff that he did not want to have to contest. As it turned out, his opponent, Abdullah Abdullah, who was his first foreign minister, dropped out anyway, saying he couldn't trust the administration of the election simply because the commission that actually runs the election was in place during that the abuses that took place in August. And by the way, they're still there. The very same people who ran that commission are still there. The commission staff itself was involved in ballot box stuffing on behalf of Hamid Karzai. And so it's, you know, you have this watchdog commission that he's now taken control of. But the problem has already existed. The problem was already a shadow being cast over the parliamentary elections, which are to take place in September, simply because the same commission that presided over the abuses that took place last August is the very same commission, the so-called Independent Election Commission of Afghanistan. Now, what this does is pose a fairly complicated dilemma for the international community, and particularly the United States, because holding these parliamentary elections are part of their blueprint for political reform, for bringing an end to the insurgency and extracting NATO troops. They are faced with a dilemma. As I said, they go ahead with this election. There's abuses, and Karzai's controlled election watchdog allows the abuses to take place. Or they withhold the money that Afghanistan requires to hold these elections, and then the elections don't get held until Karzai backs down in insisting that he's going to name all five members of this election watchdog. I think that they're going to try and develop a very sloppy compromise, which will essentially continue to allow President Karzai to control the commission, and that is, instead of him naming three Afghans to these three positions that had been taken by foreigners, he'll name maybe one, and he'll name two foreigners. But that will still leave the majority of the commissioners, there are five commissioners, his guys, and they will be able to determine whatever they decide they want to determine on his behalf. And so that will be presented, I think, to Afghans and to the world as a compromise, as a example of Karzai's flexibility. But it won't be, because essentially he will continue to exercise control over not just the so-called Independent Electoral Commission, but the watchdog that's supposed to ensure that abuses don't take place.
Okay, if you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Chuck, you're on the air with Jonathan Landay. Hi, Chuck.
Yes, I guess it's a time for Marines to call today. I had some experiences in Vietnam also, and my consideration at this point is that it appears that we've really got the war sanitized the same way we did in Iraq, where we're talking about principles as opposed to what the effect is on Americans in their lives. I had a rifle company in I Corps in Vietnam and was at Khe Sanh, and I can remember after the fact seeing pictures of what the effects were. And I know it really had an effect on our population. Mm-hmm. And I would just like a comment about what you think about that.
Well, I mean, you already see that that public opinion has turned against, or is turning against, continued American involvement in Afghanistan, and that kind of tends to undermine, or at least have a major impact on the administration and the administration's conduct and the military's conduct of the war. But again, it's hard to see an easy way out of this. And the fact is that if the United States right now, because of the errors that were made in the past on Afghanistan,
at the outset, you mean?
Yes, mm-hmm. And for the first 7 years, mm-hmm. Is essentially now reduced to what I like to call, for want of a better expression, a dam. The United States' presence in Afghanistan is holding back a catastrophic resumption of the civil war that the United States interrupted when it went in there in 2001. That's essentially what the United States is, the role that we're playing there now. And
yes,
the hope is that with the remaining time, enough can be done to restore security and bring about a modicum of honest government, enough stability will be restored that the United States and its allies can withdraw. I don't know that that's possible.
Well, yeah, that's my point exactly. We saw what happened in Vietnam with governments that were corrupt and probably were involved in upsetting one corrupt government just to allow another. And your comments about Malaya were, I think, so pertinent that it was police action.
Exactly.
That the British learned quickly. The French didn't learn at Dien Bien Phu. We didn't learn in Vietnam.
We're not learning it now either.
Exactly.
And
we're delaying and costing more lives as we delay.
But the problem there is, as I said, if we remove the dam that we are there, that our military represents in Afghanistan now, that region, and that's what my talk about is going to be about tomorrow. We're talking about a potential catastrophic destabilization of a region in which there are nuclear weapons, and specifically, I'm referring to Pakistan. And Pakistan has something around the order of 80 nuclear weapons, but they have tons of nuclear waste. There are many nuclear reactor facilities and other related facilities in Pakistan. It is already fighting an internal insurrection related to what's going on in Afghanistan. And that is what I believe should be sort of the preeminent concern of the United States and every country in the world, because if those nuclear devices or even the waste fall into the hands of extremists, the consequences of that could be absolutely catastrophic.
Thanks for your call, Chuck. Let's see. Jonathan, you are on the air, not Jonathan Lendy, but Jonathan the caller. How you doing?
Okay.
I think I'm seeing a trend in the United States towards more isolationism. I think a lot of these military forays you've commented haven't worked out exactly as we expected. And I'm wondering, there's like one superpower left now, if you exclude nuclear weapons, which you just mentioned. I'm wondering if it's possible for us to just pull out of everywhere and say to everywhere, you know, we're not helping any of you militarily anymore. You can all do whatever you want. It's your land. The only thing we care about is the nuclear weapons. If there's any threat or any probability of nuclear weapons coming, you can be sure we'll be there in 12 minutes and do something about it. Other than that, if you feel you need our military help, come and plead to the president. Other than that, we're pulling out. And I think we're going to head towards that direction, in part because I think the finances of the United States aren't going to be able to support this these kind of military forays much longer. And secondly, that's a self-determination issue in most of these countries. And finally, if our military actions don't seem to have much benefit. So I'd like to hear what you have to say about what I see as the coming isolationist approach. And is there a way to forge our way through that, to let all the chips fall where they may, and as the only superpower to come in after the fact and provide valid help. One of the earlier calls, the older lady, I totally agreed with her.
Okay.
And I think we should say, we're going to go in, we'll build wells, we'll build infrastructure, we'll build it. We're not going to give you the money to do it because you wasted.
Well,
you're corrupt.
Let's see what Jonathan has to say about that. Yep, Jonathan?
We simply don't have the resources to do that, to go and do that ourselves in places like Afghanistan. We would have done it already. But let me go back to your main point about isolationism. There's, of course, the economic problems that the United States, the recession that the United States may be emerging from, takes precedence over anything else, particularly when you have an unemployment rate of over 9%. And naturally, people want to solve problems here rather than problems overseas. But the fact is that we have a very the world is small, the world has shrunk, and a problem in one country can have a massive impact around the world. You're talking about going in and addressing a problem after it's occurred. That tends to take much more blood and treasure than trying to preempt a problem before it occurs. Let me posit this other possibility. The United States' role, for as controversial as it has been one in many parts of the world that's been the stabilizing factor. I think if you talk to a lot of experts, they'll tell you that the reason there hasn't been a major war in Asia since Vietnam is because of the security alliances that the United States has forged with countries in that region. Without the United States' presence, the economic advances that have been made that have brought and enhanced democracy in places like South Korea and Taiwan and even Japan may not have been possible. And so I don't think it's possible for the United States to simply say, okay, we'll see you later, we're leaving. The globalization has taken the world too far, and the idea that everything would be up for grabs in a world where there are shrinking resources, shrinking particularly when it comes to energy, and I would emphasize that oil. We're still at the petroleum-based economy. There's no way the United States would be able to assure itself and others of and the world of the free flow of these of oil in particular if it was simply to pull up stakes everywhere and retreat behind its Atlantic and Pacific coasts.
All righty. We've run out of time. Sorry to our callers or our emailers. We can't get to those. Thanks, Jonathan Landay, for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Jonathan is going to be speaking at Ohio State University and also at Ohio Wesleyan University. You can get to more information about that by going to WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have the links you need for that. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.